Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. For more information, visit rothcheese.com. This week on Meat and Three, we're getting semantic to understand the deeper meaning behind some of the foods we love. First, we'll look at the big debate happening around the word milk.
Who the hell are you to tell me what is the name of my product and my landscape and everything we've cared about when, you know, you don't have anything invested in except to put out a little money to buy it? It's our entire life.
Then we get the lowdown on the language of cider.
So the first thing that's really confusing about dryness is that it has nothing to do with how something actually feels in your mouth.
And finally, we get our fill of tiki talk.
You don't walk into a tiki bar and be like, oh yeah, this is what Polynesia is probably like. Like, it's supposed to be like fantasy and stuff. That's the hard part. It's so easy to do tiki bad, and that's where it gets a bad name.
Tune into this week's episode of Meat and Three. That's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Good morning. This is the Main Course OG. I'm Emily Pearson, and I am here in studios on Thursday, April 18th with Patrick Martins.
Thanks for having me.
Brandon Hoy.
It's a pleasure.
And Mike Edison is out today. He is recovering. So Mike, we'll see you next week.
I think someone slipped Mike a Mickey. Mm.
A Mikey.
Exactly. So we have some great guests for the Weekly Grill this week. We're in studio here with Joe Carroll of Fetsau, St. Anselm, and Sputin Dival. Oh, I said it right.
You did.
Here in Williamsburg. You are really a trendsetter in Williamsburg. You took over a corner that is now...
That's right.
It's all yours.
And a trendsetter in general for craft beer, for barbecue in New York.
I know. When everybody was only drinking, $2 PBRs?
Exactly.
And what was your beer price, $15 a pop?
No, at that time it was probably closer to $8 or $9 a bottle, but still.
That was like $300.
That was in what?
Yeah. That was 2003 when we opened.
So yeah, definitely put the neighborhood into a little bit of a shock, but it's welcomed. We also have Brian Kenny, a founder of Heritage Radio Network and the technology manager for Hearst Corporation's Western Properties.
That sounds so fascinating, technology.
Yeah, oh
manager.
Boy, it's sexy. Actually, I'm also director of collections and archives, which is way more interesting than technology, but we're going with the boring route
today. Well, you have to change your voicemail.
You also
it
have-
just says Western Technology. It doesn't say the archive.
I'm sorry. Now I'm going to feel like a millennial. Who leaves voicemails?
Also, you definitely need to change your voicemail to Brandon Hoy's best friend.
Yes.
What happened to that?
Beep. Hi, you've reached Brandon Hoy's best friend. I will be here holding Brandon's puppet.
I also just want to give you the award for best radio voice.
Well, thank you.
You were doing some promos when we walked in for the network, and the sound is just... I don't know. It's soothing.
Well, Emily, I started on AM in the 80s when there was still the Soviet Union that we were afraid of. We had one enemy.
Wow.
It was a simpler time.
And you were on the AM waves.
I was on
communism.
Yes, amplitude modulation. I want to do something here. I want to introduce my fellow Alamedan, Eric Koss, publisher of the Alameda Sun, who is on the line from sunny California.
Hi, guys. Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for the fine introduction.
You're welcome.
Welcome back. Eric's been on the show with us a couple times, and is it sunny at 7:04 out in Alameda?
He's delivering papers. He's out and
it
about,
is indeed.
Right?
It's Thursday.
Actually, yeah, my folks are out there delivering the paper. It's delivery day every Thursday.
I know. I was reading that you're a weekly free home delivery to, 24,000 people?
That's correct. Yep. And 7,000 online unique visitors every month, at least. So, everything we do in print, we also do online. So.
And what's happening on the front page today?
Well, we're still trying to decide on this pesky election with this homeless center they're planning to construct here in Alameda. And the city got pretty well divided over whether they wanted it or not. And While the decision seems to be clear, the people that count the votes are still counting them. So yeah,
hyperlocal, I don't care.
Hey, listen, I don't understand the problem with making a list and checking it twice. It's worked for Santa Claus.
All right. Well, yeah, he's doing pretty well.
All right. We're gonna jump in, although I feel like we already have. Our first segment of the show is the weekly based. I have an important question for everybody. How do you feed your mother?
How dare you?
Do you know? Are we all speaking the same language about mothers?
Yeah, is she that old?
I know, because this was my question. I should probably go last and let everybody else take a shot.
We were out to dinner the other night with Brian, and we were at a restaurant here in Williamsburg, Burano. We were talking to the chef Al about feeding your mother, putting yeast into it, and feeding the mother for bread and for pizza. How do you feed
your
mother?
That's a totally different question than what was going on in my head.
I was like, how do I answer this?
This is crazy.
That's where we were going. So what was your gut answer?
You always feed your mother with love, right?
Right.
Love, certainly. Time, and emotion, and always some passion. You should probably play some Bach in the background. I feel like you need a little music. You know, you want to set the mood.
Gratitude.
Yeah.
Gratitude. At least you didn't say some Al Green.
I'm a catalyst. I just walked by my mother, and I started Slow Food, Heritage Foods, Heritage Radio Network. I just walked by, and bread like starts to bubble and stuff like that. I can revive a dead mother just by walking by.
That might be an infection
ambient yeast
that you might need to take care of. I'm pretty sure there's some sort of antibiotic out there for you.
Well, there's a fungus going around that people don't know how to fix. That was on the cover of the Times today, by the way. They just can't stop it. Doctors cannot stop it, and it kills 50% of the people it touches. But most of those people have other things going on. They have weak immune systems.
Is this the one that's going through hospitals that people don't want to talk about or admit that their hospitals had it?
I read a thing this morning on my way over here about the leading cause of death in the country, and it was really pretty alarming.
What, fungus?
No, 100% of people who engage in the act of living eventually die. Wow. Now that is scary.
Yep. Nobody gets out of this life alive, right?
All right. Well,
so far.
So far. Well, that sort of brings me to the theme of our next one. With Notre Dame Cathedral burning this week, we want to know what else burned up with the church. There's energy stuck in that wood. You can't just create energy. You can't destroy it. So what happens to it? We were talking about this with Brian the other day.
Mm-hmm. I think it turned into grief, didn't it? Like a whole bunch of people got sad when the church burned. So that spirit got converted into grief, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, I think that I deal with a lot of old stone and wood and things like that. And I didn't realize that the whole ceiling was made out of 14th century trees. They called it the forest. And that's so, yeah, I just think that you're right. It turned into grief. And then the really interesting thing is that you have all these problems in the world that are intractable, and Notre Dame burns up. And then all of a sudden there's like $1 billion to fix it.
Well, by the way, that money thing is a thing that really shows that there's social inequality. There's already $1 billion, and yet that yellow vest movement, you know, they're fighting for social equality, and now $1 billion.
Catholic,
it's just a church.
Catholic Church needs more money, I think.
Yeah, right.
they're not doing so well.
I think it's grief for people like Americans and people who went junior year abroad and got laid in Paris like 2 hours after visiting the Notre Dame.
No
so
question.
It's like passionate. It's just a church. What about the fucking red wattle pig? Where when a livestock breed goes extinct, they're like, oh, the Amazon lost a plant. Wah. No, so it bothers me. It's just a church. Things die.
So things, I would say, and Joe, as an iconoclast, you might be able to shed some light on this.
Perhaps.
But things become institutions, and they stand for something larger than themselves. So what Notre Dame stood for was antiquity. And the fact that antiquity can be the root of modernity. And so when it burns up, it's like watching your uncle die or something. You just never think it would happen.
Well, it's a piece of humanity, right? And our collective history. So, you know, you feel a little loss in that sense, I guess. I don't know much about this kind of stuff, but I'm surprised knowing that the ceiling was made of wood, and it's kind of an important building, that there weren't inherent fire prevention and fire suppression devices in place. There wasn't some sort of, I don't know, some sort of system there to protect it better from fire.
Like, or like a secondary, like, or like this, a secondary roof that sat under this, this, it. You know?
Many, many cathedrals have burnt down before. Yeah. Many, you know.
Well,
many
look
old
at
places.
The museum in Brazil with all that South America. I think São Paulo had a huge fire, and their whole art museum or history museum went down. And
the National
the government
Museum.
Is not protecting its world sites as much as it should, I guess.
Well, there's a fine line between historical preservation and renovation. That's another thing that would probably be the source of an entire show. But if you were to say, if I as an American were to say, boy, is it really a good idea to have a forest supporting the roof of this cathedral?
But by the way, this is going to be fascinating, the workers and artisans who are hired to fix it. It's almost, they're going to look around. They're like, how many stonemasons are left? I mean, and it might take 40, 50 years to fix, as it took, I think, a few hundred years to build it.
But do you think, I have no idea what the intentions are. It's too soon. But will there be a modern flair to it? Will someone put their mark on it? Or are they just going to try to replicate
glass.
It?
It'll be all clear glass. Like that.
I can't imagine they would do that. I don't think anyone, you know, I think people would freak out.
Go up in arms.
Well, I think there was an RFP to redesign the spires. So we'll see. But I mean, I don't know. I think that everything that's new will be old someday. In the town where we live, Eric, there's not much that's that old, but 100. What's the oldest building in Alameda, Eric?
1982.
Oh, geez. It's like the Webster House, I think it's like 1854 or something like that.
Right.
Yeah. So,
that's, so when a
160
when
a, years or something like that.
Right. So when a 12th century building burns up, that's why there's grief.
Sure. Yeah. And like you said, it's like an uncle. It's kind of irreplaceable. You can't get those 14th century trees back.
I'm going to put the $50,000 Ann and I were going to donate to fight cancer and to support the YMCA system just to rebuild that church. That's what we want. We just want to rebuild that church. The cancer's okay for right now. It's that church that matters. Where I hooked up with that girl.
All right. So speaking of...
What's next? Well,
I think it's, you know, it's also like a symbol of the whole country of France, isn't it? I mean, it has some pretty serious...
C'est la vie, mon ami.
Anyway.
All right, so spot on.
We were lamenting the other day about change. Mostly Brian was lamenting that relief pitchers are being used to start games instead of the tradition of having an official starting pitcher. So we want to put this to food.
I wish I had my sampler right now.
I know. Jeet didn't give it to us today. So how about food? Does it bother you all that traditions are being destroyed, that there's more innovation, or is it encouraging?
But why are you booing the relief pitcher? You don't care. You want your team to win. Yeah, I mean, why it needs to be a starting pitcher? It can't be a reliever that goes the first 2-3 innings. That bothers you, really?
The fact of the matter is, it's like not the game of baseball. So for me, it's less interesting to watch. And I don't want to be the old guy that's like, get off my lawn here. But the game itself is not interesting to watch for me anymore. It's like, it's just home runs and strikeouts. And it's not baseball. It's not like there was something fun about watching baseball, watching guys move around the bases, the strategic attack of like how to score runs. Now it's just launch angles and velocity. It's like, I don't care about math enough to like watch it in motion. Like, baseball is just math in motion, and I don't need to watch it.
Well, you know, Mike Francesa, my favorite sportscaster, said, you never hear about how good an outfielder's arm is anymore. That used to be almost the first thing you would say about an outfielder, how strong is his arm. But now no one's rounding the bases. No one's being thrown out at third.
Just goes straight over his head.
A single
out of the park.
You hear about what his batting average is.
Right. Also, pretty much everyone could tell you what his launch angle and velocity bat speed is.
That was
like,
111. It was 111.
I don't care
miles.
What his bat speed velocity is. They call it velo too because they had to shorten it.
So, I would just say, get off my goddamn lawn. There's pitchers should be able to mix speeds and location. You should have a four seam fastball, a changeup, and a knuckleball. curveball and a slider is nice.
Well, everyone's become a hyper specialist, right? It's
yeah, right.
Yeah.
You know, nobody can do everything anymore. One person has to come in just to do one specific job. And
exactly.
That.
So what do you think about food? Does it bother you to see traditions collapse?
I think it's you have to have a balance of both. I think we need to kind of rework traditions and relook at traditions and innovate, but we also shouldn't lose traditions either. And that would be, like losing Notre Dame.
Right. Well, we talked to a very interesting chef named Max from Sambar, and he said, absolutely innovative is the most interesting thing to me, but you must know the classics to innovate.
Absolutely.
You cannot come in as an innovator first.
Well, I don't know.
Like Jackson Pollock learned every study for 40 years, every type of art.
To this argument, though,
it's
almost like what you just asked about baseball. Like if your team wins, what difference does it make? And in a sense, if you do something cool, and you know, and but you don't have the background. You don't. I mean, it sort of doesn't matter if you can execute something really great and interesting and delicious. I guess it doesn't really matter if you know the tradition or the history of a dish or what the classics are. But I think it's important if you care, if you give a shit about food, to know all that stuff. And I mean, I think most of what I've done has always been based on the sort of real classic example of something, and then take it from there, then modernize it. You know, change. Maybe a bit of the technique, or certainly the ingredients, upgrade the ingredients.
But the legacy of the food makes the winning better, right? So if it has a rich history and you're good at it, there's something that makes that better. So it's the same with sports, right? It's sometimes like a new franchise comes and they win, and that's great. That's the beginning of their legacy. Right. But it's the teams that are winning late in their horizon that feels good. It's another win, or they're back from the dead or something like
that.
And
there's a difference.
You want to bring something back. You're giving it life as it ages. And this all goes to this aging of wine, aging of anything. There's something important.
There's
about
a difference
that.
Between getting lucky and being consistent too.
Right.
If you could do it over and over again, that says a lot more, obviously.
A brief observation. We are in a radio station. We have a guy on the phone who is succeeding at print journalism, an old thing. Radio is an old thing that's supposed to be dead. Patrick, you have a company that sells pigs that are supposed to be extinct, right? So I think that the innovation sometimes is retrograde motion. So sometimes the innovation is to go back to the classic.
Right. And some things should die. I mean, certain breeds of pig did not taste good. So it's not about saving things to save them for nostalgia. But if it's quality, it mustn't be killed. Things that make sense, for sure.
I think you can go back to those classics and look at them and just see if you can do them better. And, you know, the innovation comes out of that. But I still think that classic original idea has to be there to build from. It's an interesting concept.
So jumping to the next question, I want to jump to this one. What is the state? Because a lot of people say you cannot recognize, the public might not know what a classic is. So they might not appreciate its subtleties or how delicate it is or how light or how refined. You know, they want something a little bit more overpowering. We were talking about that before. So manners, what is the state of politeness and decency and knowledge in the dining out public today?
Well, do you guys remember that episode of The Sopranos where Tony Soprano comes over and he just basically intimidates the guy that's wearing a baseball cap in a nice restaurant?
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you're...
Yeah, I remember
he just basically breathes on the guy and the guy feels totally uncomfortable. But I swear, like, everywhere I go, I see dudes wearing baseball caps in nice restaurants these days.
At least, you that know, would be just, me.
Yeah, and you know, from time to time, I'm like, well, does anybody else have one on? All right, I guess I'll leave mine on. But you know, it's kind of like decorum does seem to be, you know, slipping a little bit. Like, just I don't know.
Some like people who wear the flip flops onto planes.
I have mixed feelings about this. I don't know. I mean, I think that there is something nice about everyone having some level of respect for dining out. But I also feel again like. You know,
but women used to wear corsets as a matter of decorum. Right. So I mean, what are we talking about here?
And also, like, does it is it ultimately going to affect your enjoyment of the meal or the food? Or does it really, really matter if we break it down? You know, does it really have that big of an effect on anything? I think New York City is a particularly interesting place for that. If you go outside the city, people tend to and this has been the case for 20, 30 years probably, people tend to get more dressed up. They take it more seriously. You go to more places that require jackets and stuff. That kind of is gone in New York.
But what about just politeness, like decency to the waiter, understanding how to tip, knowing how to order, not being annoying? You know?
I don't know that that's changed.
I don't think that's changed at all.
There's
probably equal
you know, amount of cool people as there are jerks coming in.
That's just humanity there. Yeah. That's just the balance of dickheads versus nice people.
And
there's good, there's light and darkness all over. But that kind of stuff really hasn't changed.
And I think the restaurants that know that they're going to get screwed by someone, maybe on a tip or something like that, they're adding it in. They're planning for it. They're planning for like
also,
tourism.
Also,
no, I was just in Miami and every single restaurant, it's already included.
To be positive here, the younger dining out generation, like I mean the real younger, like the 20-year-olds and now teenagers, I see teenagers that are enjoying food. So I don't know. I have to see the positive light here that I think people are into food more than they were 20 years ago.
Absolutely.
And I think those kids are more inclined to have like a real restaurant etiquette, and
they
I see them
seriously.
They enjoy themselves. They understand
they
what
know
the,
how to maneuver around the
totally.
Restaurant.
They understand what the waiter has to go through to do it. I just see a change.
It's actually
in the younger.
I
people.
Think the younger people take it more seriously. They have a bit of reverence for it. It's usually middle-aged drunk dickheads that are like the problem. Honestly, that's
the
like,
Upper East Side.
Yeah. Basically, perhaps, yeah.
Third Avenue, Second Avenue, First Avenue.
I also think that age group is paying attention to how they dress. And if they wear a baseball hat, you hope that it's with like a stylistic fashion choice. If someone looks like a mess and totally schlumpy and like, if you're going to judge
why
them for
why is everyone looking at me right now?
I was actively not looking at you
right
until
there.
You said that.
The funny thing is I just turned really quickly to look at Patrick because I was like, how could he be talking about anything? He's wearing the same pair of corduroys he's been wearing for a month.
Well, I would also say just we should bear testament to the fact that we are oft to remember the assholes more than we are the good people.
Absolutely.
And there are less of them. And it's just that the assholes tend to be louder.
Also, you know,
than
it's
the
funny,
quiet, nice people.
The people who create problems are why so many rules and laws. It's always that one family where the kid falls off the Grand Canyon. So now it's fence. There's a wall. There's always, you remember the one terrible story or the one guy who gets mad at slow food. Right. And then so rules are made that no person can make a decision without going to the full board because of that one dude in Phoenix. You know, it's
we
really
legislate
sad.
To the lowest common denominator.
And
we
then do. Eventually there's so many rules. There's no manipulating around, you know, I mean, you just can't maneuver. Because over 100 years, there'll just be a gazillion rules, one new one every month, you know, to cover every base.
Or you just get used to breaking rules. That's the problem. I went to Cal in Berkeley. I think it was the most heavily legislated city in the world. Everything was illegal. You know, you couldn't spit.
Bunch of hippies.
Yeah.
You can't jaywalk.
It's a bunch of laid-back hippies find the most Nazi-like regime, you know, for their hippiness. They're getting yelled at if you're walking on the wrong side
of the
sidewalk.
It's like the only thing you can do is smoke pot. Outside.
The funny thing about Berkeley is it's fucking filthy. You know?
People you're just taking like, shits on the...
You're like close to the school, you're just like, how does all of this exist? But it's just so dirty all the time.
Well, but it's our dirt.
It's
Own it. Exactly.
Well, we live in a clean town, Eric. What would you say?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I think a major characteristic of Alameda is that it's an island city. And so it has like these very discreet borders that we like kind of, you know, feel like we can control what's going on our little island to some degree, even though, you know, things get out of control. But, you know, it's very different than its neighboring city of Oakland. It just developed completely different mostly because it's more isolated. Because there's no major highway that goes through it. Unlike the majority of cities in California, it has no, like...
Arterial.
Little House on the Prairie, really.
It's like City Island for you New Yorkers.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was just going to say the same thing. It's just so not connected to the rest of it. So it creates this like kind of segregated, like natural like separation from everything else. I mean, Berkeley's problem is it's just filled with kids. Like there's just no, you can't deny the destruction of a bunch of college kids, even if they're the smartest college kids in the world. They're just, it's just going to be gnarly. It just happens.
That's not. It's actually not the kids. It's the people that hang around the university that have been there since some of them since the late 50s. Seriously.
And never left.
And they never left. Sitting outside.
Yeah. How do you hide money from a hippie? You put it under the soap.
Hey. Vote for Eisenhower, okay?
All right, total deviation. We're going to play Fuck, Marry, Kill.
Oh, no.
Oh, fine.
French onion soup, meat pie, and Parmigiano Reggiano cheese.
That's a tough one.
So sharing soup is so romantic. I love sharing soup with large groups of people. I also like hiking with soup, hot soup when I go hiking.
So you're clearly going to marry.
I'm going to fuck the French onion soup.
Oh, man.
You just said you like hiking with it.
It's so romantic.
Yeah, but you just. Soup. So don't you want to marry the soup?
No, romance is for fucking.
Yeah.
Don't you know?
All right. Does anyone really have an answer for this? Not really.
I mean, I think you. What are my choices again here?
French onion soup.
Fuck.
Meat pie.
The only time he's ever asked for a question to be repeated.
I'm definitely killing meat pie.
Parmigiano Reggiano.
Yeah, marrying the Reggiano. I mean, that's a long lasting love there, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It never goes old.
It sticks around a long time in the digestive tract. So because I'll marry it.
Because of the hot Gruyere, I am going celibate, but I will marry the Parmesan Reggiano.
Everyone.
And I think I'm going to, I will probably kill the meat pie. Yeah. Sorry, meat pie.
Joe, you have a different angle?
I don't want to kill any. I mean, I like meat pie. I have no problem with meat pie.
So marry it fuck it.
But I also really like the other two, so I'm conflicted here.
All right.
Oh, you could go, Paul. You could go. What was that show about the Mormons? You could be Polly.
I'm down.
Polyamorous.
Yeah, whatever.
Just marry them all.
So, in the same vein,
that was good radio.
Is dissatisfaction with big corporations leading us back to a time where everything will be hyper local?
That's in the same vein.
Aren't we
same
vein there now? Almost
hyper local. No, corporations still rule.
Yeah, I mean, but when I don't know. Are you talking across the board in everything we do in society?
I mean, or in food? Yeah. Well, how do we conceive this?
Hyper local is a registered trademark of Octan Corporation.
No, let's narrow it to food. Go narrow it to food.
We have a long way. There's a lot more we could do, obviously, to become more hyper local. But in, you know, our lifetimes in modern American life, we've never been more local, right?
I think that's not true. Doritos.
That's not going away.
Right.
So how long is that? That's been.
I'm talking about modern American food life, food culture, right? From, let's say, World War II on. I don't think it's ever been better than it is now and more local than it is now.
Okay.
I think you have to go back to the turn of the last century and prior to get more local.
I mean, people are learning how to farm places where they never could farm before, right? There's desert towns that had Las Vegas is becoming localized. That's a crazy thing to think about, right?
That's a good point.
Like they figured out how to make their own water out of space like materials and hookers. I think they take all of the drugs. They turn the drugs into water and farmable soil. It's amazing.
They take the juice out of the mats at all the bars, all the mat shots. No, I think in terms of hyperlocal, I saw a story on TV. It was probably a reality show where a woman was making bread with yeast off her body. That's hyperlocal.
That's like
very local.
That's going to smell. That's terrible. Oh,
I didn't say I ate it.
Really.
All right.
We probably
but he definitely thought about eating it.
We'll never ask that question again.
I think you're right, Eric. We need both.
Okay.
Yeah.
This weekend's Passover and Easter. There's a new book, The 100 Most Jewish Foods, a highly debatable list, offering an irreverent list of the most Jewish foods to savor.
Just in time for Passover.
No, that wasn't what I was saying. Patrick, you just told me about Amy Schumer.
We hung out with Amy Schumer. Husband, and she just did a podcast where she and her friends talked about being Jewish. So we thought that with all this kind of Jewish tetwar bustling about, we would ask, what is the one Jewish food you cannot do without?
Bagel.
Gefilte.
That's a real thing.
So Patrick this morning told me that I was not allowed to pick something that is just, you know, culturally Jewish. It had to be a food of Judaism.
Yeah,
and
because
I was
if
like,
not,
so you want me to pick matzah?
I think the bagel bread that is never just a rose. German food.
So, so he's saying Egypt. No bagels.
Like,
because bagels
going to
be, bagels like 90%, bagels are like everybody's choice.
He's telling me I can't pick white fish, I can't pick smoked salmon, I can't pick
pastrami. I would say pastrami, but.
Pastrami, yeah. That's
true. But the Jews have pastrami in the desert?
No. That's not a historically Jewish dish.
What about arugula? Did anyone other than a Jew ever make arugula?
How about bitter herbs?
Oh, yeah.
I read my Old Testament.
Matzah. So I will say they did have the Humantashen cookie made from Haman's hat.
Yes.
I'm not Jewish, but I grew up with an Italian mom who grew up with a girlfriend of hers who was Jewish in the Bronx.
Italian mothers and Jewish mothers.
Especially from New York City. It's a fine line. And I grew up eating matzah brei all the time for breakfast and absolutely love it. Still, I make it for my kids now.
Mm. Do you stock matzah in your pantry year round?
Let me tell you something. Matzah is one of my favorite things to eat. I eat a lot of matzah.
What's the healthiest bread?
Probably. I guess.
It's not low in calorie, especially not the egg matzah, which tastes better.
I'll go with matzah ball soup if I can't have bagels.
You can have bagels. I allow bagel.
We'll discuss it.
We'll
get with the rabbis and we'll discuss it.
This was the great schism in the main course OG was based on what is a Jewish food. And that's when Emily got her own show and Patrick had his own show.
I know. Yeah. We get into it. I like that you used the word
gefilte.
Nice, the word schism. That was when the Pope left and went to Avignon, right? And he started his own.
That's right.
Yeah, that's good. Schism.
That's
a good word.
All right, everyone here is successful. I'd like to know, describe your management style in under 30 seconds. I will start. Mine is...
You're already interrupting. Yes. We know your management style.
Always interrupt.
Interrupt.
There's my answer. No, my real answer was going to be, I think I always focus on the positive thing that someone is doing before going into the, you know, maybe constructive criticism.
You're like, hey, great job. Okay. For the next 3 hours, we will go through a laundry list of how you've disappointed. No, just kidding. That's interesting. So you focus on the positive.
Yeah, at least I think that you compliment someone, you tell them what they're doing right, and then you work in the things that aren't going so well.
Starting on positive, that's good. Brian, what's your management style?
I tell my people that you are responsible for your successes, and I am responsible for your failures, and your job is to make me not have to be responsible that often.
That's good.
That's a good one.
Wow. Joe?
Yeah.
You know, I feel like my job is to set my employees up for success and to then back them up, provide them with whatever I possibly can, whatever they need to continue to be successful. And I try to stay out of their way. I try to find people who know what I'm trying to achieve and they can execute that for me, and which is difficult. That's not always the easiest part. And then kind of stay out of their way and just support them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm more... I have two styles. One is to tear them down so that you can build them back up. No, that's not really. But I was going to say, my
that
more
is
like
totally the truth.
John McEnroe, where I am the one suffering. You've made me suffer. This is terrible for me.
Usually first you tear them down and then you tell them how much you're suffering because you had to tear them down.
No. I can have a mean streak if I feel something is wrong. Someone's been wrong about something or moral or dishonest or not upfront. But no, basically, I mean, I always want things to be happy and positive and growing. Interesting. Things have to stay interesting or else it's like a quagmire. And people aren't happy. What would you say yours is? You have like 150 employees, 200 employees.
I like to take a more Eastern approach and flow like water. That would be my management style. Just flow like water. Oftentimes I think, just fucking roll downstream on this one. Just roll downstream. You'll find a rock to hang on to, and soon this will all be over.
It's nice to know you're driving the ship there.
Eric, what do you got for us?
Oh, well, I pretty much like what everybody said, but I will add by saying that I take a kind of the buck stops here approach, which is the fact that I tell my employees, like, I've pretty much done everybody's job at one point or another, and I've done them all at once, too, for a while. So it's like I could do it without you, but you're here to help me. So, you know, step up and make sure you're worth it.
Damn, that's ballsy. Yeah, no. If someone takes five times as long to do something, that then you want to help them. You're a coach and as a manager. It's something that you're supposed to know more about than they do. And even if you don't know anything, like it's technology, you still know what kind of questions to ask to make sure that they're maxing out. Also, sometimes you run, sometimes you walk. Sometimes you run, and it's okay to walk. And when you're walking or stopping, it's great, and it has to be embraced. But, you know, you can't be walking all the time.
I've only seen you run a few times, and it was like weird.
No one likes to see me run.
Somebody should have slow motion videotaped it and put it on some sort of meme.
My running is a lot like walking. My running is about the same as walking.
All right, on that note, we are going to take a quick break, and we'll be back with more with Joe, Brian, and Eric.
For the interview part of the show.
Yes, for the interview part of the show.
Today's program was brought to you by Roth Cheese, a pioneer in the U.S. specialty cheese movement. Roth is in its 25th year of making specialty cheese in the rolling hills of southern Wisconsin. With strong Swiss heritage, Roth is best known for its award-winning Alpine-style cheeses under the name Grand Cru. Fresh Wisconsin milk, combined with expertise and affinage, is how Roth creates high-quality, great-tasting cheese year after year. In 2016, hard work paid off when out of over 2,000 contenders, Roth Grand Cru Sirchois was named world champion at the World Cheese Championship. For more information, visit rothcheese.com.
Are you enjoying this podcast? Heritage Radio Network has plenty more. My name is Diane Stemple.
And I'm Elena Santigade, and we're the hosts of Cutting the Curd here on Heritage Radio Network. Featuring interviews with makers and mongers and everybody in between, this show is a downright funky look at the world of artisan cheese.
You can find Cutting the Curd wherever you listen to podcasts and on heritageradionetwork.org.
And we're back. We were just talking about, I proposed having a Passover matzah pizza available at Roberta's on Easter.
Nice. Just,
Brandon, something to think about.
A flat, crispy pizza.
Specifically with, on Easter with bitter, for the Jews.
With bitter herbs.
And lamb.
And lamb. That's
fish. Bitter herbs, lamb, no cheese, no mixing
jelly,
milk
just
and
the
meat.
Gefilte jelly.
That's the worst part
that
of it.
That is the best. That's, I like part. To put that gefilte jelly and buttermilk together and then with my coffee. Oh, God,
oh, so good. All right, we are the Main Course OG, of course, broadcasting live from Roberta's here in Bushwick. We are here in studio with Joe Carroll, Brian Kenny, and we have Eric Koss on the line. We are going to jump into our segment, The Weekly Grill. Joe.
Yes.
You are the owner of St. Anselm, Fetzau, Spoot and Dival, and you're doing a partnership with Star Restaurants, expanding outside of New York. Mm-hmm. What rules have you broken within your niche? Those of being craft beer, barbecue, and steakhouses? Or are you a rule follower?
No, I mean, well, you know, in a weird way, I am a rule follower that made me break rules. Because when we first opened Spite and Dival, for example, you know, beer, ale should be served at a very particular temperature, lager at a different temperature. But nobody was doing that. So I made sure that we had two refrigerators set at very distinctly different temperatures. And there were just things like that that I felt like were details that were rules that nobody was following. So by kind of following those rules, I was going against the grain of what was happening. But
you were
I was
innovative
really,
by going to
a
classic.
In a weird way, right. We didn't use branded beer glasses. We used nice Riedel wine glasses to serve the beer in. So there were things that just seemed logical to me that seemed like this is the way it should be done, but nobody was doing it.
What about how you set up your restaurants, like the flow of it? Or being like a pickup stand for barbecue.
So that's to me, that's not innovative at all. I mean, to me, that's the New York deli, right? Or an Italian deli for that. Any kind of like that's. I grew up buying food, eating food that way all the time, and it seemed logical to do it that way. It seemed, you know, to me there was a really distinct connection between barbecue, particularly Central Texas barbecue, and the New York deli, and I just felt like, well, you know, just draw that line, make that connection happen. It was there. So that's where that whole, you know, style of ordering and everything came up.
So you're a rule breaker follower. You follow by breaking.
I think it depends on the rule. It's you got to take everything individually and look at it and what rules are worth following and what rules need to be broken.
So what if you had these three great places, craft beer, steakhouse, barbecue, mm-hmm. and you had to open the same three in two different cities? Like what would be two cities that excite you, and maybe what would be two cities that would not excite you?
Well, you know, I just opened a St. Anselm back in September in D.C., and I got to tell you, man, I am really in love with the D.C. market. I'll tell you why. It's been underserved for so long, and it is a really wealthy market. It's a densely populated city. It's a really small city.
It's a transient city, though.
A little bit, but there's a lot of money, and it's a really social city. And it's mostly not politicians. It's lawyers and lobbyists going out every night, spending a lot of money. And they are so hungry, man, for something cool and something interesting. They've been so underserved for basically the history of D.C. There's been very little of interest there. And the moment we opened down there, they were just, you know, kicking in the door to get in. They just couldn't wait for something else, you know.
So is there another market like D.C.?
I don't know, actually, that there is in that way that has all those ingredients. And the only issue with market like D.C. versus New York or perhaps even some other markets is there's no professional service industry pool to hire from. There's not a giant pool of waiters and waitresses and bussers and dishwashers, unlike New York.
That exists all over the United States.
Yeah, I would
New York is kind of a phenomenon when it comes to the mass amount of like industry people that exist. I mean, you could.
What do you mean, like when your dishwasher walks out and you can have one within 2 hours because someone calls a friend?
Yeah. You definitely can. And like even in California, San Francisco, for instance, is probably maybe the second largest.
Right,
food industry,
Chicago,
and then Chicago, and theirs is even like a third of the size of our pool.
Yeah, so that's the only challenge. But beyond that, DC I think is a very interesting market because it has these components that a lot of other cities don't.
Eric, I have a similar question for you. You know, your paper, The Alameda Sun, you are in a hyper-local market. If you were to launch another paper, what's the next hyper-local location anywhere in the country that you would maybe pick?
Well, you know, I think Joe used a pretty key word, which was underserved. I think there's a number of sort of medium-sized cities out there that are under the shadow of a larger, more prominent city that probably aren't getting the kind of attention that they deserve. Our city is about 80,000 people, and for the most part, the city government here doesn't get covered by the sort of nightly news or major news sources. And so we fill a kind of niche, and I think that's the main reason why we're here. So if there was another niche like that, where there was a medium-sized community that wasn't getting its news published, that would be the kind of place to go. And to be honest, the big old city next door, Oakland, California, no longer has a really serious print operation. The Oakland Tribune is no more. It's been gobbled up by this thing called the East Bay Times, which covers multiple cities and none of them very well. And so I think that there is a place for every city to have its own print publication, and whether that print publication takes its form like electronically is sort of a separate discussion, maybe for a whole nother show. But just the fact that news content is being produced somehow is a niche, and I think there's plenty of those that are wide open because the big media corporations gobbled up all these small newsrooms, and yet the need that those newsrooms fulfilled is no longer being fulfilled. So that niche remains, right?
There's no document of record for many large cities, you know, four to 800,000 person cities. There's no newspaper. There's something that regurgitates wire stories, and then maybe there's not even classifieds. There might be obituaries. That's broken.
Right. And there might be some opinionated blogs, which tend to have some kind of agenda and aren't very objective and don't necessarily follow any sort of journalistic ethics, not like anybody is anymore. But the idea is that, blogs tend to take some kind of a position that isn't as objective.
How many small town newspapers still exist? I know the small town I grew up in, Napa, still has the Napa Register, has for years. I guess there's like a romantic side that thinks that there's still a lot of small towns that still have a paper.
I think the Napa Register got bought by the Santa Rosa. But I mean,
probably very few, unless it's a very small city, maybe.
They're owned by larger corporations,
which is not
who
good.
Just also use the same articles, the same AP wire, and they do a little bit of local content.
Very little. I wrote for the Reading Record Searchlight, and it still had a local entertainment section. It's still a local government section. It was a good sized newspaper, and over the course, I started writing for them in 2000, and over the 5 years that I wrote for them, it just shrunk every year. And it was still one of the most profitable papers in... It was Scripps Howard. Now it's McClatchy, I think.
It was one of the most
profitable...
In Reading?
Well, no. And if you looked at the profit margin on the paper, it was one of the most profitable papers in the entire syndicate. Hmm. So what did they do? They stripped out all the stuff that made it good and kept the money. Right,
by the way, you make your money, your employer is one of the largest print publication organizations in the world, the Hearst Corporation. But I mean, that
among other things,
they do a lot of different things. They have a huge ranch, which is how we met. But what does it mean to be the archivist for the Hearst family?
I do technology and archives, so they're linked. So really what I'm doing is, the beauty of my job in art collections is that I get to make decisions that for a couple hundred years. So there are pieces of art that we conserve that we're preserving them, conserving them so that they'll be there for the family in 100 years.
And for the society, right? Because it's not only owned by the family.
I mean, in some
museums,
cases.
Museums, right?
Yeah, but no, I don't do that. I deal with the stuff on the family estates. Huh. And so I deal with the papers that document William Randolph Hearst's life and career. And the technology side, I'm bringing technology to these properties like the San Simeon Ranch and the estate up by Mount Shasta in far northern California, where they're still running data on copper lines that were put in the early 1900s. And we just put in a 7-mile fiber optic backbone. So the beauty of my job is it stands at the nexus of modernity and antiquity, which now, the present, is the confluence of the past and the future, right? So
what's the saga? Where's the state of the fountain, the Shasta Mountain fountain?
Which fountain was
the big fountain that you had to lift up with the crane?
Yeah.
It was a big saga for many years.
Yeah, no, it's ongoing. We're finishing, right? My team right now, today, is finishing conservation on the 6,000-pound limestone bowl. The property where we are working, there are no right angles and nothing's level. So when you go to lift a 6,000-pound limestone bowl that's cracked 3/4 of the way through, you do it with a gantry and chain hoists, and you do it slowly and methodically. So it's been a 3-year project. And we are going to reinstall all that when I get back from New York.
I think I remember this property as a kid. This is the one that has like doors that open into nothing.
And it's very strange. Yeah, and
strange
there's the tunnel that goes to the Hall of the Mountain King where the Lemurians live. Or so I read on the internet. They haven't showed it to me yet. But no, it's a really interesting job. When I left the beef job and Roland Camacho took it over, he worked with me for 8 years. And I got this job. You know, it was, I studied archaeology, and then I was in technology as a software engineer, and then I got into agriculture. I worked at the Hearst Museum of Anthropology as an undergrad. So it was basically a 25-year loop where I went back to where I started. So it's been cool. And I love the fact that we helped you guys start this.
Yeah, well, he brought a station that was in a limousine. Coming here at 8 in the morning, and I think I texted Brandon, Chris, and I was like, guys, please Mr. Hurst is here. He really loves your place, wants to see it. And you guys came and opened early that day.
And
he fell in love with the place.
And the pork chop.
Yeah.
And that wood fired. Yeah, that
good. That big old double cutter.
Yeah. Wow,
that thing out of the pizza oven.
And he still tells that story because he thought when we got out here, he's like, this is like something out of The Sopranos. He said, did you take me out here to have me whacked? I'm like, no.
Well, because this was
we're here to dine.
2008, so it was a different neighborhood.
A double cut 8 a.m. pork chop.
He was a visionary because he felt in this place, which everybody felt when they first walked in here, especially back then, that there was something very permanent about this and that his money would be well spent, that it wouldn't just be a fly-by-night restaurant. I mean, everything in it was handmade.
What he said was, this is Patrick's thing. And I said, yeah. And he said, then let's do it.
Wow. And he made it 10 years, this guy.
10 years. And we're both on the board, me and Brandon, and I'm chairman still, but I've offered to step down after 10.
Because
I don't want to hold it back. I don't want to hold it back.
That's the right attitude.
Well,
no, this is exactly what he was talking about, his management style. He's playing victim right now,
right.
So then later he could yell at us all.
I'll just, you know, give my brain a rest. I'll probably get Alzheimer's from not
from all the stress.
Much,
yeah.
But, you know, it's up to you guys.
No, Turkmenbashi did the same thing, too, when he took over in Turkmenistan. Hey, I'll be happy to let go of the reins, you know. Then he shut down the schools.
Fidel is like, this is very temporary.
I'm only doing this till we find somebody better.
All right. Well, it is the 10-year anniversary of Heritage Radio Network. You've been listening to The Main Course OG. Thank you, everyone, for joining us, Joe, Brian, and Eric. And stick around for Tech Bites up at 11, and we'll see you guys next week.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Cool. Thank you. Thanks.
Great.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.